You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM broadcasting from Burnaby.
Hello and welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your host Brandon and I'm joined today by Hale. You are listening to our Reading the Pre-Socratics series. On our last episode, we got the chance to talk about Heraclitus and sift through the various aphorisms that survive. And on this episode, we are going to be talking about the other big pre-Socratic thinker, Parmenides. If there was ever a thinker who came into a period and changed the way that people engaged with thought and really reconfigured how it is that everyone goes about what they do, at least in terms of intellectual history. I'm trying to say that what's really exciting about Parmenides is that we get to see the first kind of Copernican revolution in Western philosophy. We get to see someone change the way that thought is done from there on after. You can see so much of what comes after Parmenides as responding to, trying to revise, or just standing in the shadow of Parmenides. So his impact is enormous. It's very important. And we're going to get into why that is. It's enough to just say it. We'll be reading some of his passages. Fragments, sure, but we'll talk a bit about the state of his work as well. So I just wanted to introduce Parmenides a little bit in terms of biography. So Parmenides was born in Elea, which is on the eastern coast of the Italian peninsula. So what's interesting about this is Parmenides is actually the first Italian-born philosopher. He does belong to the Italian school of thought, but he was also the first one who was actually born on the Italian peninsula. So if you'll remember Pythagoras, he moves from Samos, and which is on an island off the Ionian coast, and goes to Croton, which is the southern it's on the southern end of the Italian peninsula. It's to the west, southwest of the Italian peninsula. But he's not born there. He brings his ideas. Parmenides is really interesting because he's the first person who is responding to Italian ideas, so Pythagorean ideas about the what we would call, you know, eternal measures or divine matters, as opposed to merely empirical ideas. Elea was founded by Ionians too, so there is discussion in the literature about how Italian Parmenides' thought is. The founding of Elea was founded by the Phocaeans, who were a polis that existed north of the Ionian coast. Now, that was within the Lydian kingdom. At this point, before Parmenides was born, the Persians come in and they take over the Lydian kingdom, and the Phocaeans have to leave. And the Phocaeans are excellent shipbuilders, apparently. And after some misadventures, they land in Elea, found this city. Parmenides is born there. And then Elea goes down in the history of philosophy as the Eleatics. Everyone in Elea is known as the Eleatics. So that's a bit about how Parmenides kind of geographic situation. I bring this up because I do kind of find the geographic situation of the Greek world at the time interesting, especially considering that so many people are being influenced by the travel that they engage in. Some people like Parmenides don't travel, but he obviously is influenced by Ionian ideas somehow.
The Pythagoreans, obviously we're talking about, you know, early what you would call Italian philosophy, which obviously mingles a lot with what is effectively like Greek colonization at the time. An interesting note that has come up, if our listeners remember at all about the Pythagorean episode, that there's a lot of questions about what Pythagoreanism was really about, because there's so little surviving original text. And there's just as an aside, there's some suspicion that Parmenides himself was quite influenced by the Pythagoreans, and that that his work might actually be a kind of one of the closest reflections of at least certain Pythagorean ideas that we have today. It's hard to confirm that, but just based on his location and some other writings and stuff that we know about him, that it seems likely that he was in contact with and influenced by, especially early in his life, potentially, like, you know, very genuine Pythagorean early sects and ideas.
Yeah, and that would make a lot of sense given the geographic positions that Ilia and Croton, their situation next to each other. But not only that, if you actually do look at the thought, there is a lot of resemblance. There seems to be responses to Pythagoras. So we'll get into this idea of duality that Parmenides and how Parmenides deals with duality. If you'll remember, the Pythagoreans did have a two-column chart where on one side they would put the limited and on the other side they would put the unlimited and rack up reality and its phenomena in terms of these things. So things that have proportion and things that don't have proportion. It'll show how Parmenides makes or what he makes of that. I mean, he will bring in that Pythagorean idea of proportion or limit and take it to its logical extremes. So if there is Pythagorean ideas in Parmenides, they're buried under Parmenides' own original responses to that. So trying to reconstruct Pythagorean ideas from that, definitely, I don't know if you can reconstruct it, but there is certainly a response there. Well, so the other thing that's really interesting in terms of the history is that Parmenides is a little different in terms of his surviving work. I go on and I introduce the fragments to each of these thinkers. A lot of them don't. So early on with the Milesians, we essentially don't have any fragments. We only have testimonia. That we get testimonia, you know, secondhand accounts of what is said is lucky. We're lucky to have testimonia. If we get really lucky, we get fragments. So people quoting and saying, you know, this thinker said this, we get fragments, which we then reconstruct and put together and assemble. Heraclitus is interesting. I mentioned before that we have so many fragments that we can actually get the semblance that we have a part of a book here. We don't really know the order of them because they just crop up at random. But we really do have a sense that we have a substantial part of Heraclitus' text. With Parmenides, we are really, really lucky because not only do we have a substantial part of his text, it's actually quoted in full in passages by a single person. This is Simplicius. He is writing a commentary on Aristotle's Physics, and he wants to bring in Parmenides to talk about Aristotle's Physics, and he says explicitly, I'm going to write out all of this stuff because Parmenides' poem is getting really rare and I want to make sure that it survives. So he gives us huge passages. What's really interesting about this is not only do we get substantial portions of his thought, I mean, we have that with Heraclitus, but with Parmenides, we actually get to see exactly how Parmenides argued for this stuff in the order and the structure that it's given. So we are in a very good position to assess at least one part of Parmenides' poem. So thank you, Simplicius.
Yeah, it's worth, and I mean, maybe at that point, it's worth jumping in. You said one part that Parmenides' poem is quite known for having multiple sections, the first two of which are, I think most scholars would agree, were probably the most interesting and the most important anyways, although it's hard to know. But the last section only has a very small amount surviving. We kind of, from the other sections, we kind of have an idea of what it was about and what it probably looked like, but it just did not survive in the same way that the both what often is called the prologue and the way of truth have survived. Well, obviously we're going to get into that because it's super important.
Yeah, the second, or I guess the third part, but the second way that Parmenides talks about, I get the feeling that he kind of felt like he had to include it, and I can talk about why that is when we get to when it's introduced. But it is, just to describe it, it's a cosmogony. It is a creation of the world. We got, now we have lots of those. We've got Hesiod, and we've got Anaximander. We don't have it, but this has been written over before. This is kind of it's tried territory, and Parmenides feels like he needs to have a cosmogony, how the world came about. But what's really innovative and interesting is the principle, like the negative principle of why that is not actually that important. What is important is the stuff we have. So why don't we jump right into it then?
Yeah, why don't we, we're going to, like we've done so far in the series, I'm going to read some sections here. We're going to read the prologue, which generally is called the prologue. I don't think Parmenides actually called it that. But it's worth noting that for our listeners that what we're going to be reading today is, it is a poem. So it was written in meter. And it was actually performed, was it performed in Italy, or did he, I know he did go to Athens, didn't he, at one point? Was that performed?
I don't know if it was performed, but we do know that it was read quite widely. Like Plato is apparently quite familiar with it. I don't know if it was performed. He might have performed it. So the other thing that is interesting about this is that it is a poem too. Waterfield, one of the commentators from the literature that I've read, talked about how at the time it still was seen as proper that if you have something important to say, you need to put it in a form that is going to spread. And at the time, people are still reading and writing poems. There's still a thriving bardic tradition. So yeah, it might have been performed or recited, but I know that it was also written down at one point.
And I do believe that it was entered into, because obviously with the bardic tradition, there was pretty extensive contests and performances. And I do believe that we know it was entered into some sort of bardic tradition contest and that it actually lost.
Oh, yeah. So that's another thing too, is many commentators who can read and parse and judge
say
Greek,
it's a bad poem.
Yeah, they say it's not. It's kind of bumbling. It's not that great. Which is fine, because intellectually it's apparently a gem.
It would have been read in meter, and that it is in fact a poem, but not a good poem, but an interesting poem nonetheless for us students of philosophy. So I'm going to read the prologue. So basically, just to get an idea, because it might sound a little weird if you're not really familiar with this kind of stuff, Parmenides is basically telling us a story about how he was introduced, how he was basically the world of the gods, worlds of the goddesses, took him up on a journey to discover certain, or to be revealed to certain kinds of knowledge, the different categories of knowledge, truths about the nature of the world. And he does that through basically telling a story of what is revealed to him and how it's revealed to him. So to start off with the prologue, to start off with what is effectively the intro, how he kind of introduces the whole situation, he's basically been brought up to be taken on a path to, you know, the different forms of truth, the different forms of knowledge. So I'll start now. The mares which carry me to what I desire brought me to the sun's path, that famous highway which carries the man who knows above every city. Along that road I was carried by the wise horses, drawing at full speed the chariot, driven by the daughters of the sun. The axle, whirled round by the wheels, blazed and snagged in the sockets as the goddesses, pulling the veils from their faces, left the house of night and hastened me toward the light. The paths of night and day are blocked by gates, extending high into the air and framed by a lintel and stone threshold. The great doors with their double bolts are controlled by avenging justice. The maidens plied her. By the way, Justice is the goddess, Justice. The maidens plied her with gentle words and skillfully persuaded her to release the bolts without delay. Pivoting on bronze pins, the doors flew open to create a wide entryway. Straight through and along the broad road, the maidens guided the horses and chariot. The goddess kindly received me, took my right hand in hers, and spoke these words to me. Young man, who has been escorted to my house by immortal charioteers, I welcome you. It is not evil that has sent you to travel this way, far from the beaten track of men, but both right and justice. It is proper for you to learn all things, both the unchanging heart of complete truth, and also how things seem to mortals, in which there is no truth. Despite the lack of truth, you must learn how what seems to be must be because it is accepted. So that's our first, that's the first, at least in my text, we'll call it the first fragment, generally called the prologue or the introduction, where we really get the stage setting of him going to meet the goddess of justice and being escorted by all sorts of other, you know, godlike figures and stuff. But it also, like, of all of it, there's little tidbits, but for me, obviously, the end, and I'll read it again, is this, because this, I should say, this is actually a quote from the goddess of justice herself. So it's, you know, it's pretty important. You know, once again, she says, young man who has been escorted to my house by immortal charioteers, I welcome you. It is not evil that has set you to travel this way, far from the beaten, this is where it gets really important to me, far from the beaten track of men, but both right and justice. It is proper for you to learn all things, both the unchanging heart of complete truth and also how things seem to mortals, in which there is no truth.
Yeah. So this is interesting. This is really important, right? So the goddess is going to introduce Parmenides to two ways. One of those is in my so I have a different translation, and that's okay, but so one is the steady heart of well-rounded truth will be introduced. Then this introduces the way of truth, but the other is the way of opinion or the way of seeming or way of appearances. This is not the way of truth. And so we're not actually, you shouldn't take that road, but as it turns out, as we talked about, the second part of the poem will be going through this way of truth as well. You'll need to know this as well for, and the reason is interesting. It's more or less so people can't run it by you, right? You need to know this to be immune from it.
And this is like you mentioned earlier to the audience that Parmenides is, you know, kind of introduces a Copernican revolution, and here we can kind of get some hints of that. You know, we did see some of this earlier in Heraclitus, but Parmenides really lays it bare that there's this division in reality between what is and, you know, what is experienced by mortals, by human beings, the world that we perceive, and that, you know, that, and of course philosophy often goes this direction from this point on of, you know, the world of appearance, the world of seeming is not the locale of what is, it's not the locale of truth, it's something else. And that obviously there's this kind of, you can kind of extrapolate from that it's like things like the senses, the sensory world, all that kind of stuff obviously has some sort of illusionary aspect to it.
Yeah, I think that's a good parallel to draw between Parmenides and Heraclitus. And I should say too, oftentimes Parmenides and Heraclitus are sort of pitted against each other as these great intellectual rivals. And I think that there is an important core to that. Obviously, they have deep disagreements about what constitutes reality. In this case, they do agree that there is suspicion that we have to raise about, and we have to be cautious about the way that we go about attaining the truth or what is. For Heraclitus, the senses present you with things, but those things, their nature is not substantial. They are bound by, or their limit is the relationships that constitute those things, right? So Heraclitus doesn't think that there is an underlying substance. Things are just composed of the relationships. Whereas Parmenides is going to say it is. There is a substantial reality underpinning all of these things that you need to get to. And the way that you get to that is by overcoming your attachment to your sensory sort of methods. But it's you should note too, what's interesting about this is that in a certain way, Heraclitus and Parmenides are in agreement. Both of them are saying in some form or another, all is one. For Parmenides, being is, and there is nothing that is not being because it's nothing to be other than being. Whereas for Heraclitus, all is one because all is sustained in relation with one another.
And just in regards to the structure of the poem itself, like the content and, you know, and why it's structured in this way, one of the interesting commentaries about it, which is kind of obvious, but it's something that, you know, we might skip over when reading it, is, you know, it's clear that Parmenides felt that what he also was doing was very important, that he had something very important, revolutionary to say. And that's clear because he transitions the voice of the poem, that the, you know, the kind of the giver of the information, away from himself and over to the goddess of justice, right? Basically, that's, you know, for the rest of the poem, that's who's going to be kind of talking, really. Like, obviously, they're talking through Parmenides, but Parmenides is saying, okay, here's this conversation I had. The goddess came to me. She said, hey, even though you're immortal, obviously, I'm not directly quoting right now. The goddess didn't say, hey, guy, you're immortal. But, you know, she brings this mortal in to, you know, into her, so I was about to call it lair, but that sounds too,
well, actually, right. That is interesting because, so the chariot image sort of, the impression that I get, and I think that most people get when they read this, is that he's going to the sun, you know, thanks to the haste with which the maiden daughters of the sun drove the carriage, we're going up. Actually, we're descending downwards. We're going, the image of the gates to any Greek listener at the time, they would very clearly hear this as the gates to Hades. So Parmenides is actually going to the underworld in this case, which is just it might actually be something like a lair.
Yeah, so even if we're going to the lair of the goddess.
Yeah.
Not necessarily an evil lair.
We're going into the cave.
And basically, yeah, and you know, she has important, you know, very, like, basically divine stuff to say. So this is more than just, like, a divine revelation, which was a very, classic trope. This is effectively Parmenides quoting a conversation with a god, with a godlike being, with a goddess, which really emphasizes, I think, to the audience, at least at the time, and probably still to us, this is really, like, revolutionary stuff, right? This isn't just, I'm not just hearing voices, I'm not just having this feeling of some divine powers or whatever. I went to a place, talked to a goddess, and this is actually, they were like, I have a really important specific message for you directly, which really emphasizes that. The other thing I think with the prologue that's really interesting is, it's, you know, there's a part that says, the paths of night and day are blocked by gates extending high into the air and framed by lintel and stone threshold. A lot of scholars have had discussions about what the paths of night and day are, you know, what the kind of meaning of that is. I think the most obvious one, so there's really two that I've read about. You can come in, but one is that it's the, you know, night is the kind of darkness we're going to be, that's the way of seeming, and day is in the light, right? We're going to, so, you know, we're going to this place, we're getting both, we're going to be shown both paths, as we're told. The other one I've read is that, you know, the paths of night and day, we're going past the path of night and day, we're going through the gates, and the path of night and day, that night and day is kind of used as a metaphor for the illusory nature of change. That we say that there's we have a tendency, as we'll see discussing further for audience, that, you know, part of being a human being is this idea that you see transition, that you see change, and that is an illusion. that that's you're going past that transition. Those things don't have differentiation in the way we think they do. And it's probably the simplest example that we all experience.
Yeah, I think that is what I think about it when I read that Parmenides is going past the path of night and day. He's transcending these dualities or these dichotomies. And this goes back to the Pythagorean ideas that Parmenides is very well likely responding to. The Pythagoreans constituted a reality in proportion. And so they said, look, if there's proportion, there's also non-proportion. If there's limit, there's non-limit. Reality is dualistic. But Parmenides is saying, no, no, no. I heard from the goddess in a place that was beyond duality, the truth that being is. There is only one thing in reality. I just want to respond to your observation that Parmenides is having the truth revealed to him. I think that's actually, I hadn't realized this, but that's actually another parallel with Heraclitus, who says himself, you know, listening not to me, but to the Logos, it is wise to agree that all is one. So both Heraclitus and Parmenides are having the truth revealed to them. But the other is that in a certain, I kind of want to read this because it's a little cheeky. Sometimes we think about, you know, endings and spoilers and whatnot, but actually right from the very first line, we have the ending. In my translation, my carriage was drawn by the mares, which carry me to the limits of my heart's desire. Literally, we know that this is going to turn out well for Parmenides right on the first line. As a man of wisdom, he's going to get precisely what he wants. He's going to have the truth revealed to him. There's no spoiler warnings possible here. It's just, hey, up front, what satisfies the wise man, what we all seek, we're going to get. I got it.
This is true of any fragment, but especially of a more like fleshed out piece like this. There are many different translations. More or less cover the basics the same, but when they get into the details, it can be quite different. But for the purpose of this episode, just know that the basic ideas we're covering here will fit most, but probably the worst of translations.
Yeah. Listen, it's interesting listening to yours. It sounds a bit plain and a little clumsy, but I almost wonder if that's intentional considering the reception of the poem.
So now we're going to move on to the way of truth. So, and for our listeners, remember, that this is more or less, it's structured. It's actually supposed to be a quote. So even though this is Parmenides, it's really a goddess talking to him. This is what she's saying to him. So the goddess says this to Parmenides. So come now, I will tell you, and you must tell others, the only conceivable ways of thinking. The first, that it is and it must be, is the persuasive way, for it goes with truth. The other way of thinking, that it is not and it cannot be, is wholly impossible. That is impossible because you cannot know what is not, nor can you express it. For it is the same thing which can be thought and which can be. So before, there's more to it, but you know what? I think it's worth it just, so that's what's called, often called fragment 2 and 3 of the second section. And I think it's worth stopping for a moment and going over that, because we're really getting at some of the philosophical revolution that we're talking about with Parmenides. As much as it might seem kind of plain to you, to listeners, first of all, we're introducing some really important ideas around structure, around logic, and then obviously some extremely important metaphysical concepts. So, you know, when he says first that it is and it must be, anything that exists has to exist. Like, this is, like, obviously that seems like circular reasoning, but it's also, you know, kind of irrefutable. And Parmenides is obviously putting this forward as an irrefutable, you know, argument. Like, there's, you know, what there is. Like, how can you argue against that?
Yeah, being right? is.
Yeah, being is. And then also, too, we get into this really interesting discussion of the negative, of negation, of non-being, which is basically, you know, people want to talk about what isn't, but they're wrong.
They can't.
Like, how do you talk about what doesn't exist?